is not observed. It is simply a recognition of what is. And in exactly the same context, you must think of Christianity as never being a legal function, nor does God ever punish. It is simply a recognition of alienation. That's hell. Over here on this side, you have coercion and the processes of the law. And coercion and sanctions and how that works is something that I can talk to you about tomorrow. And you're overdue for a cup of coffee. Go away. Best demonstrated in the context of what one might call the law of domestic relations, marriage and divorce. We have an absolutely horrible problem here, stemming largely out of the fact that we have failed to distinguish clearly between the spiritual problems of the relationship of man to man and the legal problems of marriage, divorce, and other status problems by which families are organized. We have persisted in confusing spiritual and legal questions in the context of family to the mutual injury of both systems. I have not yet, in the 2 hours that we've spent together on this problem, told you about law and equity. Yesterday, as we tried a couple of very simple problems about an award in lieu of homestead, for those of you who were sitting, and I asked you how you might resolve such a problem, you instinctively, immediately reached for, well, let's split the difference. Let's not say yes or no, because that's too tough. Let's kind of divide it. You take some and you take some. Law cannot do this, because in law you must decide a thing. It is his or it is hers. As I mentioned yesterday, you think of Solomon and the two women contesting over the babies. You see, Solomon was playing this same game. Each of you take half, so you'll be fine. You cannot do that without destroying the thing over which the conflict has arisen. So law must either say yes or no. Now that's very difficult because by definition, as we saw, law only addresses itself to those problems which have no rational answer. If a problem can be rationally answered by a scientific method, you answer it that way. It's only when it's an insoluble problem that we resort to a process of reaching an amicable decision, hopefully an amicable decision, where we finally say it's going to be that way. The car was going 37 and a half miles an hour, no matter what the evidence, no matter how wide the range of evidence may have been. It is simply a decision which is made, you could say, if you weren't being careful, arbitrarily. It isn't really arbitrary. It's done by the best process we've been able to devise, and finally we announce it as being so, and then it is so for purposes of law. The umpire who says that was a strike is right. He is always right. He cannot be wrong. No matter if 5,000 people in the bleachers rise up and scream and protest and hurl pop bottles, he is right and they are wrong, because he's the guy who gets to say. Now, there would be a possibility in a ball game of setting up cameras from all angles, and every time a ball is thrown, you could all these flashes like that, and you could rush off and develop the plates, yeah, calibrate them, come back a half an hour later and say, scientifically, we are much more precise about this. The odds of naming it as a strike or a ball, that we've come much closer to that hypothetical box in there than the umpire. But in the very process of doing this, you would destroy baseball. So there are places in life in which the answer is really, literally, physically impossible. How many dollars worth does a broken arm hurt? Because it doesn't have an answer. Or in which the price of being more precise, baseball games, taking photographs of pitched balls, the price of greater precision is so high and the gain is so small that we prefer to do it imprecisely rather than more precisely. But all of these, we are talking about the relevant judgment here. Lawyers never tell you when they are careful that they know the answer to something. They say that they will give you a judgment, an opinion, a decision. And the one thing, as we've already said, that a lawyer can never say, that a judge can never say, is, I can't answer that problem. It's too tough for me. Because that's the function of the law. He must decide. So in many states, including my own, for example, we have a statute that says that if a judge refuses to decide after the case has been given to him, 3 months later his pay is withheld until he decides. He must decide. Otherwise, we won't give him a salary. How would you like to be a judge on inadequate information under a rule of law that does not precisely fit and be compelled to answer a question of who lives or dies? It's enough to make a conservative out of a person. You don't like to be thrust into that kind of impossible decision-making process, and yet in the function of the law, it must. It is for this reason that the law develops the slogan that Carol teases me about all the time. That is, although we are frequently in error, we are never in doubt. Because when the chips are down, you simply have to say whether it was right or was wrong, if now is said, and within the scheme of jurisprudence, it is final, and that's it. So when the California court said that Charlie Chaplin was the father of that child, Charlie Chaplin was the father of that child. The fact that a transfusion would not have worked because their blood types were incompatible, and that scientifically he could not have been the father of that child, biologically, is beside the point. You're not going to transfuse the child. What you're going to do is support the child. And a legal problem was before the court, not a biological problem. I hope that if I ever need my appendix removed, that the determination where to cut will not be made by a jurist. On the other hand, I hope that when we come to the problems of treating addiction as a social problem, the determination will not be made by the medic. These are different problems, and they must be approached differently. In that context, then, if you understand what I'm trying to say, let's look at what we call the family. Now, obviously, the first question that one would want to ask is, why is family, marriage, divorce, a legal problem at all? Why isn't it handled by Mr. Cohn, social worker, or by the pastor as a spiritual problem, or by the medic as a medical problem? Why is family, why is marriage and divorce, why is this a legal problem? Why do we have statutes that say something about this? Well, what is a family? What is marriage? I hear people giving the weirdest definitions for those words. I know people who think that marriage has something to do with love and affection, mutual companionship, and all kinds of nonsense like that. When obviously anybody who's thinking right knows that marriage has to do with filing joint tax returns, inheritance of property, insurance policies, definition of citizenship, and who owns a house, and who has to sign a deed, and a thousand other questions like that. That's what marriage is about. Marriage has something to do with where children are conceived and how children are reared. It provides a system within which we answer these problems. Now, it may be that there is something in family that has to do with mutual love and affection and fidelity and these other problems too. But then that's somebody else's problem, not mine. As a lawyer, I'm talking about a system in which society is trying to develop certain things that we believe are significant. And those things of significance are things like property definitions. How can I buy a house from somebody else and know that I'm going to be permitted to own it and occupy it and someday perhaps sell it again? In order to answer that, I've got to know that I've taken the property interest in the people who own it. In order to say that, I've got to know something about the system that owned it before. That is, the corporation, the partnership, the legal person, the legal system called the family. So there are property problems. Then there is a problem of avoidance of violence in our society that becomes very much of a legal concern for reasons that we've talked about in the last few days. Marriage is at the bottom of this. During the Second World War, when I spent a few years with Claire Chennault in China, an organization at that time was known as the Flying Tigers. We had a grand experiment once. We wanted to cut down the rate of syphilis. We wanted to cut down other problems. They were concomitant with promiscuity on the part of our soldiers down in various cities. And so the United States government set up a not well advertised about fairly well-stocked House of Prostitution. It was to be for Americans only. And the purpose was to avoid the problems that come with prostitution in the city streets generally with American soldiers. The experience with that lasted less than a month for the very simple reason that violence resulted. A American soldier would identify with Susie. That was his girl. Now, consciously, rationally, he knew that she was a prostitute available to all Americans. But he identified with her. And when another boy went to see Susie, we had two murders, a number of stabbings, all kinds of violence in our own barracks from persons who could not handle this kind of failure to identify with a human being. Now, whatever the truth of the matter is, I don't care about that right now. What I'm saying is that marriage is one way of avoiding these kinds of frictions in society. The identification of exclusive property. This is my territory. You leave it alone. Here you can do fascinating things, for example, with seals. Two seals will contest over the real property that they govern. This is my hunk of land, and that's your hunk of land. The original definition of how much territory a seal gets to cover depends upon how big and how vicious he is. Once the territorial division has been made, if you stand back and throw fish out, when a fish lands in one seal's territory, he gets it. There's no fight. Because they've identified the relative property interests that they have, and seals don't fight about their fish. It's his fish. It's his fish. But you slide one out on the line, neutral territory, and all hell breaks loose. Even if you've got a little seal and a big seal, because it's the lack of accurate perception of whose it is. And a contest arises. And because there isn't a good judicial system operating among the seals, they fight. And we also can avoid much violence in connection with our living together as male and female and as families if we work out our perceptions closely enough so we know who owns whom. The idea of exclusive intercourse is very closely related to this sort of thing. So you get property rights, you get the avoidance of violence, and then thirdly, marriage or family gives us a system, an organization within which we give birth to and rear our young. You mustn't think of family as being anything more than simply another corporation or another partnership. I was fascinated by Barbara Collins the other day, Larry, when she was saying that there might come a time when society will start asking itself genetic questions about should we try and develop certain type of children? Will you live to see the time when you go down to the county courthouse and make application to produce one male child with the following specifications to be delivered on or about May something? And that sounds kind of funny, although if I live a normal lifespan, I think I will live to see something fairly close to that. Be that as it may, the point that I want to make right now is, we're there. We've been doing this for several hundred years, only we've done it by indirection of saying who may marry whom. This is the way that we control reproduction, theoretically. We have set up a system where no marriage, no intercourse, therefore no children. And if we find that certain persons ought not to reproduce, we do not authorize them to go into the business of rearing children. If you want to go into the business of manufacturing widgets, set up a corporation or a partnership, you've got to go down to the right place and make application for a charter. In order to get such a charter, you're going to have to show that you've got the proper financing, that you have the proper skills, whatever is necessary by definition to the manufacturing of widgets. Or if you want to go into barbering, or surgery, or practice of law, or into the ministry, or whatever it may be, you have to get licensed. Now, this is a way we protect society from having untutored and untrained people going around doing things which subjects the public to unreasonable hazards. Not everyone may drive a car. You must have certain capacities. You've got to be able to pass the test and get the license before we will arm you with several thousand pounds of material and turn you loose on the unsuspecting public. This is also true of marriage, don't you see? Not everyone is to be armed with the capacity to reproduce and permitted to run at large, dropping children in all directions, who become social burdens. You must go down and get a license. In order to become chartered, licensed, to go into the business of rearing a family, you have to meet certain tests. before you can get your license. Now, this is not a bad idea. The only thing is that our implementation of it is so horrible. All of those things that we ought to be looking at in terms of measuring what will make a good family are the things that we largely ignore. And a lot of things that are very significant to whether or not the family will work, and we think are beyond anything that we may legitimately ask questions about at all. The result is that the standards for licensing in marriage are apt to be rather ridiculous. Why? Well, the reason why is because we started out with the concept of family as being a theological, a made in heaven. There were no bad marriages because God chose them all. See? You can't have a bad marriage if God picked out the partners. That's almost as bad as saying that the IBM machine could go sour. Do you know that if you got the right kind of data put in, the answer comes out is right, and that marriage is made in heaven, and no fair fudging. It can't go bad. Well, history demonstrates that because of evil or because of whatever you want to call it at the moment, and I won't burden the record with that just now, some marriages do go bad. But what kind of questions do we ask people when they get married? I think that my own state here in Washington is probably about as barbaric as any. We, for example, are interested in knowing whether or not the male has syphilis. It never occurred to us that a female might have syphilis, so we wouldn't investigate that. It seems to us a little bit too onerous to take a blood test, so we just ask the guy, are you syphilitic? You'd be surprised how many say no. Or we think, for example, that persons who are insane and possibly have something which is genetic, hereditary, ought not to marry. And so we have written into our statutes that persons who are idiots are not permitted to marry. Now, again, that's a rather hard thing to evaluate. So when you go down to the county auditor, one of the things that he does is a check. And he gives you a piece of paper that says, if you're an idiot, check here. we ask people, see, are you insane? We do not ask a lot of significant questions. For example, we know statistically that a marriage entered into by a man and a woman, both of whom are under the age of 21, has a breakup rate at least six times higher than marriages entered into by persons who are, let's say, at the age of 23 or 24. Now, if we really wanted to reduce the number of marital bankruptcies, divorces, if you want to call it that for a moment, if we really wanted to do something about that, we would screen out these obvious risks, and we can identify a lot of them. I think there's no question what we have the sociological information that's necessary and the technical skills to know what marriages are going to survive and those that are not. It's a very high degree of probability. However, we won't do it. We permit marriages to go on. Now, why, for example, should a state of a civilized, a relatively civilized group of people, such as we have in the state of Washington, I hope, why should we have a state of law in which it is possible for eight-year-olds to marry each other? Now, it's true that you say that people under the age of 17 will not marry unless the judge gives his permission. But if, for example, a girl is pregnant, the judge will almost routinely and automatically give his permission to marry. Why? Because he thinks that marriage is going to be successful in the long pull? Oh, get out. Don't even try to sell me that. You know as well as I do that given that age, that circumstance, and the forced marriage in today's society is going to crumble almost before they get outside the door. What's going to happen is they'll produce another child or two, legitimate, to be sure, having a name. Then comes the divorce. Then comes the tragedy. Why do we insist upon that? We insist upon that because we've got a theological hang-up that says that somehow or other, if you take these children already having experienced intercourse, the woman already being pregnant, and then you ram them through a legal ceremony, that somehow or other you have shriven them, that the error is gone. Somehow or other the mistake is undone. The child is legitimate. As long as the child is either conceived in or born inside of holy matrimony, nothing else matters. It's only when the child is conceived outside of this legal relationship and born outside of this relationship that somehow or other it's wrong. Yeah. A child is a legitimate child is either conceived in or born in marriage, even if you just barely make it, you know. You get a ceremony just before the birth. I've been looking for a long time for a case that I wanted to use in my course casebook that I've written, and I finally got it. The delightful case. The child is conceived before marriage, there is a marriage, divorce, and then the child is born. Being carried through does not legitimize the child. You've got to make it inside someplace. Well, this is an illustration. Licensing is a good idea, but we've chosen all the wrong grounds. Why have we chosen the wrong premises upon which to determine whether or not we will permit people to marry? Well, it's because the grounds that we have chosen are directly related to, developed out of, the descendants of theological principles. And we are not talking about a spiritual problem at this point. We are talking about the inheritance of property, the avoidance of violence, the development of a unit in which to rear children. Those are legal social problems. Those are not spiritual problems. Now wait, don't hit me yet. I'm not saying that they're unrelated to the lifestyle of a person. But the lifestyle of a person, that is a theological problem, is something that sets for him his goals, his values, his objectives, which he tries to implement them by using wheelbarrows, books, and rules. You don't get your values out of the rules. These are there for implementation or expression, conveyance. They are not there to establish the principles that you go after. Here's how you think about that a little bit, if you like. After we've gone through this peculiar process of licensing, we then go through kind of another irrational thing called ceremonies for marriages. We're going to insist now that there be some time and place at which somebody says something magic, and you transform. Theologically, we would say that we convert a person from one status to another status. There's a very direct theological analogy here of going from the non-redeemed to the redeemed, or going from illegitimate to a legitimate by adoption, or going from single to married. Now, we're going to insist upon a ceremony here, and it's got some very nice, interesting features about it. For example, after you get your license, the next thing you have to do is, this is published in the newspaper. Notice is an intent to wed. And then there's a ceremony, and all kinds of interesting things happen there, and a minister comes up, a minister might, who announces, a pastor, that is, a clergyman, who comes out and announces that by the authority vested in me by the state of Washington, which is always an interesting thing, especially in a society which purports to segregate the religious from the legal aspect of life, as an agent of the state of Washington, I hereby pronounce you man and wife. Then he fills out a piece of paper, and he sends it back to the county auditor, and the county auditor writes it into a book. What's going on, actually, is prior to Martin Luther, the guy who said that marriage was not a sacrament and was not just a spiritual concern, was a matter of civil concern for the state. Martin Luther in our society is the guy that we can thank for divorces. Marriage is not a sacrament. Marriage is a civil problem. That's why it's a legal problem. All right, think about that a little bit. You know, a child is born, he gets a birth certificate. That proves he's entitled to inherit property and get workman's compensation and other things like that. Then he is baptized. The birth certificate comes over here from the state and it handles all the legal problems. The baptism is a sacrament and handles the spiritual aspects of this matter. A person dies, he gets a death certificate. That entitles him to be buried. Then, if you like, there is a ceremony conducted by the church or by the Masons or somebody else in which there's a burial. And we don't insist that these are the same thing. But when you want to get married, you sort of flop in here through a legal licensing process, and then you run out and your friend is a pastor who's ready to perform marriages at the drop of the hat in order to pay for the organ or whatever it may be. You get your inning later. I'm sorry about that. And we muss this thing up. Why? All right, you know perfectly good and well what's going on. First place, not everyone should marry everyone. And so we have the publication of the ban. It used to be in the parish that the pastor would step into the pulpit and say, John is thinking about marrying Clarice, and I'm going to announce this the next few Sundays. If anybody knows any good reason why they shouldn't get married, let us know about it. We'll interrupt. Well, we still do this, see? I know that you people, as good citizens, every night go home and take your newspaper, run down the notices of intent to wed. And suddenly you say, my gosh! John's purporting to marry Clarice. Let's go down to the auditor and say, don't issue that license. Well, you do, don't you? That's what it's there for. And then the announcement of the wedding. And so you go to the wedding, and the minister stands up, and he looks around the audience, and he says, if anyone knows any reason why this couple should not be joined together, let him speak now. So you stand up and say, there are a few things I'd like to say about you. This is a matter, this is a social problem, this is a community interest, and I don't think this is going to be a good wedding, and I want to protest. I don't think these people ought to be married. Whereupon they put you in one of these things on the way. But we preserve the form. Then the minister fills out the certificate and he sends it back to the auditor. What? You're making a record. The reason for a marriage ceremony is publicity, so that the whole community can know that something significant is going to go on and get in its order and write what it wants. Making a record and giving a person what the law calls a locus penitentiae, a place of repentance, where you face them up and you say, wilt thou? And that's the place where the guy is supposed to go into deep thought. My guy, they're serious about things. This is serious. And if I say I will, I've had it. It's a place of repentance. It's one last chance to bail out. Now, sometimes we get them in the state where they are not thinking about that at the time, and you don't impress upon the person the sincerity of what's going to happen to him and the gravity of the step that he's taking. Instead, we kind of muss it. Can we have a ceremony that goes here out through the JP or out through the clergyman? And it results in all kinds of grief. I don't have time to demonstrate this very much, but just let me give you a couple illustrations of cases that I've known. There was, for example, a Polish couple, neither of whom spoke English. They wanted to get married in the state of Washington. They went down to the county auditor, and they were speaking through a little girl who spoke some Polish and some English as an interpreter. Paid the $5, got their license, filled it out. They went home happily believing that they were now married. Because in Europe, you go down to the counterpart of the auditor's office, you fill out a form, pay your money, and legally, you are married. Now, sacramentally, you may have to go talk to the priest. Italy, for example, has an official legal marriage, always through the mayor or the county auditor's office, and then there is a church ceremony over here. So, good old Nick and his wife went home, and they lived, or his illegitimate sex partner went home, and for 18 years they lived in sin, producing a child or two along the way. And one day Nick got killed on the job, and his paramour went down and applied for workman's compensation. And they asked her, are you married? And she said, yes, whipping out the marriage license. Did you ever get to a minister? No. Sorry, but you don't get workman's compensation. Neither you nor your children. You are not a widow, they are bastards. Now there's something just terribly wrong about that. Just terribly wrong about that kind of a system. Or take the rather jolly case that I had a little bit of myself, and I hope and look forward with eager anticipation to more litigation out of this same problem. A delightful young man and woman in the city of Seattle, from well-established and wealthy families, perfectly eligible to marry. Went down and got a marriage license, picked up their friends, they were going to go out to a JP, have a ceremony, go on out to CPAC airport, and fly off to Hawaii for their honeymoon. Well, on the way out to the JP, they stopped for a drink, and led to another drink, and pretty soon their friends took them out to Puerto Montana, and they flew away to Hawaii. A couple days later, when they were unpacking the other suitcase, they came across their unused marriage certificates. They got on the telephone. What happened? You got drunk and obnoxious, we put you on the airplane. You mean we're not married? No, you're not married. Now what to do? Well, they set up, by courtesy of the phone company, a telephone pool. The two kids in Hawaii, the two witnesses, and a good old clergyman in the state of Washington. And they read each other the marriage ceremony over the telephone. Then they sent the marriage license back. He filled it out, sent it down to the auditor. Well, things didn't go too well for the kids. They were planning on spending a whole month on honeymoon. And before the month was over, they got at each other, and they decided they wasn't a good marriage. So they didn't want to be married anymore. They came back, do we have to get a divorce? Well, sure, if you're married, are we married? The Washington statute says that the persons who wish to be married shall appear before an official. Can you appear telephonically? Very nice question. When one of our young pastors in Seattle purported to marry in Seattle a couple who were licensed to marry in California on a California marriage license, and that's because he was a good theologian and a fat-headed lawyer, and tried to send the return back down to California, they bounced it and sent it back. And he had to go smoke the kids out of their two-week honeymoon and make them go down and get a Washington license to do it again. Fortunately, he found out about it. Otherwise, 20 years later, somebody would die, and they wouldn't inherit, and they wouldn't get the insurance, and they wouldn't get the tax exemptions, and Uncle Sam would be coming back to make them pay a new tax, and so forth.
Isn't a common law wife, or am I reading?
We'll get this in just a second, see. Now, in this kind of a situation, where these kids didn't know whether they were married or not married, the ones in Hawaii, they decided that, well, they just as soon not be married, and so they decided they'd never been married. Without any kind of action, since then they have both again purported to marry someone else. I don't know whether they're married to the second couple or not. Depends whether or not they were married to the first ones. I only know that they're both happily producing children and amassing wealth. And sooner or later somebody's going to die and it's going to be great. There's going to be litigation until it runs out your ear. Lovely situation. Now why do we get into this kind of a hang-up? Because somehow or other we think that the church adds. Or the ceremony has something. What does it add? Are we not really performing a disservice to a legal system? People want to be married in the church, let them go to the church for a ceremony, like baptism or a funeral. But let's not confuse the legal structure over here. I don't care about that particularly, except that we, by insisting upon this confusion of spiritual and legal problems, of confusing law and gospel, if you will, of confusing the tools that God has given us to work with, wheelbarrows, books, and rules, by confusing those with the essence, the lifestyle, which is Christianity, and insisting upon defining our rules of marital relationship in terms which are unrealistic for the objectives that we are going after, inheritance, protection, and rearing of children. We are performing a real disservice, and we as a church, you see, ought to be trying to clarify this. I once tried to introduce a bill into the legislature of the state of Washington to do something about this, and sort of quivered in anticipation of having the whole of clergydom descend upon me in wrath. And I was protecting over here, and I got struck from the rear. It wasn't the clergy that got after me, it was the Floral Association. Now, there are other kinds of formalities that may result in marriage, and one of them is the one you just mentioned, so-called common law marriage. Common law marriage is simply a man and a woman contractually saying to each other that we will hold out each other as man and wife, and we regard ourselves as being married. Common law marriages came to us originally out of Scotland. They were known for a time in Russia. They came with us in the United States as the wagons moved west, and there was neither clergy nor justice of the peace around to perform the ceremonies, and wagon loads full of young men and young women. Something was obviously going to happen, and so we adopted the principle that marriage was essentially a contract, and if they contracted with each other, they were married legally. Now, the thing wrong with that is that there's no publicity. You never get a chance to go down and fuss about it. There is no locus penitentiae. Nobody lines them up and says, are you really thinking about this? Are you sober? Do you realize what you're getting into? This is your chance to back out. And there's no record. And the lack of record is the important thing, because it's a very, very difficult thing to know who is married to whom in our society. There's a great deal of confusion about that. I would guess that there are 100,000 couples, at least, who think they are married around the country and who are not, because marriages and divorces are invalidated with such regularity that it's very hard to keep the books straight. That brings me to the next thing that I've got to talk about, and that is, how do you determine the validity of a marital relationship? There are words that I'm sure all of you have heard before, such as annulment, a decree of nullity, and divorce. These are many very different things, although people in common parlance put the tree of nullity with a Y on the end and annulment into one thing. When you think about eligibility in America, you have certain types of prohibitions. For example, we say that a person who is not 21 years of age may not marry a man, or 18 for a girl in the state of Washington, may not marry without parental consent. Does that mean that they are incapable of marrying physically? Well, obviously not. They do it every day. It means that they are not permitted. That is, the law prohibits. It says you shouldn't do that. But it's almost routine for youngsters to show up at the auditor's office and say, I am 21, I'm 18, and they're really not. Or if they decide to go through the form of getting parental permission, they grab somebody who looks old enough to be a parent, and that person comes down and says, I'm a parent, I give my permission, the license is issued. Now what shall we say about the union that relates, that results out of this sort of thing? Shall we say that it's void, that there is no marriage at all? Or shall we say that, well, you shouldn't have done that, but now that you've done it, it's better to recognize the fact and say that you're married. Well, the law has decided that where the couple has gone through the ceremony, where the record has been made, where there's been intercourse, where perhaps there is a conception, that it's better to recognize the fact that the relationship has been formed, although in violation of a rule. We may apply a sanction of some sort. We may fine them. We may even put them in jail. But he goes to jail a married man. Why? Well, because we've got this thing. We have this feeling that if there's been conception, or even if there's been intercourse, you know, if the marriage has been consummated, I'm talking about law, then you can't undo it. As the Washington court said in a relatively recent opinion, it would be an abscess upon the body politic and a private curse to undo that relationship. And you see how we are coming down so heavily upon the fact that if there is intercourse, that's it, kids, that's it. This is a theological hang-up that's come into the question of who inherits property, who supports whom, who pays the tax, where are you a citizen, and these things. And I'm arguing at the moment that if we're answering these questions, we ought to use those rules. If we are concerned about this status, we ought to be concerned about these tests of validity. Well, when a woman is tricked or defrauded, where the man says to her, I am wealthy and I love children and I never beat women, she relying upon that, marries him, and finds out he hates kids, beats women, and is dirt poor, can she say, I have been deceived, and because I've been deceived, I want out? If I go down to buy a refrigerator and the salesman goes beyond the kind of ordinary puffing that's permissible, you know, it's all right for him to tell me this is the sweetest little icebox in the world, but if he tells me that it's got this kind of an engine and it doesn't have that kind, he really misrepresents essentially. I can rescind the contract. I can give him the thing back and take my money back. So if the woman finds that she's bought a defective product, shouldn't she be able to take it down and say, here, I want my money back? Or if a man thinks that he's buying a new commodity and gets one that's used, shouldn't he be able to take it back and say, here, you gave me the wrong thing. I want a rescission. I want this thing canceled. So we have a concept that for certain types of defects in the contractual agreement, that is, misrepresentations which go to the essence of the contract, not little things. You know, if the man says that it's a very sweet little ice box and it never makes a noise above a purr, and really if it goes boom, 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 not too loud, that's a matter of degree. And although there's been some misrepresentation, it isn't enough so I can put the ice box back. If a woman is told by a man that he is wealthy and he's just moderately wealthy, that's not enough of a misrepresentation. But if you get to something which is an essential misrepresentation, which is going to destroy the validity of the marriage, it won't work. The children ultimately will be without parents, this kind of thing. Then we can say it's better to terminate that marriage quickly, avoid the procreation of unfortunate children who will not have a normal house in which to grow up and a normal family to which to relate. Better to undo it quickly. Makes sense, doesn't it? Now, what are the grounds that we look at? Chastity. Pregnancy. Essential things like that, see? Because everyone knows that if a woman is unchaste at the time of marriage, there's not a chance that that marriage will succeed. Something, however, like the fact that the man is a 3 times loser for a felony, that he has committed a murder or two, well, that's not essential. That has nothing to do with sex. Indeed, it isn't even a theological problem. So obviously, you can't get a rescission in the marriage under those circumstances. It has to go to something which is essentially, historically, a spiritual problem. It's a hang-up, a misdescription out of a theological base which has been inarticulately transferred over to a legal system, most inappropriately. Do you understand what I'm talking about? An annulment is the remedy that we give to a person who has been deceived, tricked, or forced into a marriage. The person who has been injured has the right to come in and say, I want my money back because I didn't get the refrigerator that you described. You gave me a used one instead of a new one, or whatever it may be. And if there is the proper type of defect in the contractual relationship, force, fraud, deceit, see, this kind of thing, the person who has been deceived may annul. And an annulment is like an eraser. It blocks out. It says that it was never there. You undo the transaction. A decree of nullity, however, is simply a declaration by the court that there never was a marriage. A man has a living spouse. He is legally unable. He lacks capacity to marry somebody else. He purports to marry somebody else. That is, he gets a license. Purges himself, goes through a ceremony, purges himself some more, comes out, lives with a woman, produces a couple children. One day he gets tired and he says, honey, I got news for you. I'm going goodbye. You're not my wife anyway. I'm just an old bigamist. I didn't have capacity to marry you. The law recognizes this fact. And it says, obviously, there never was a marriage. It isn't that we're going to eliminate one, to expunge it because of a defect or a weakness in it, but we simply say it was never there. Does that make any sense to you that a man ought to be able to walk away from the woman after having treated her thus shoddily? That he ought to be able to walk away from those bastards and not provide for their support? That he ought just to be able to drop this because we stand in such horror of bigamy? Is there any sociological basis for this sort of thing? Does it make sense in terms of property or support or the avoidance of violence or a record? Or are you talking about the preservation of a sacramental, a spiritual sort of a concept? Yeah.
In such cases, isn't there usually obligated to support the children?
In a few states. We happen to be one of them. In the state of Washington, it's not necessary for the father to be married to the mother. It's not necessary for them to have capacity to marry each other if there's a ceremony. Ceremony produces legitimate children in the state of Washington, even though they're not really married to each other. That's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? I'm a legitimate child, although my mother was not married to my father. So, right, ladies and gentlemen, that's good, sound thinking. If you're interested in providing support, the sense of property, the avoidance of violence, and these other things that you're trying to get. Divorce, of course, is neither of these. Divorce is rather a recognition that a valid marriage is now to be terminated. It's a scissors. Cuts off the relationship rather than an eraser that erases it or simply a declaration that says it's never there. I should say to you in this connection that law has very few tools with which to work. Really, there are only 3 things that the law can do, and you see them here in these examples. The law can order something to be done or not to be done. Pay support. Give her the house. Something of that sort. Or the law can declare a fact. You are single. You are married. And when the law declares the fact, it's so. Remember, we've settled that already. No matter whether it's so or not, it is so, legally. Or the law can change your status. You don't like being married? Okay, ready? You're not married anymore. You can change your status. You don't like being a bastard? Okay, wham! You're legitimate. Not everybody can do that. God can do it with sinners and conversion. Judges can do it in terms of status. Sir? No, only health and strength. Consideration of life. As far as grounds are concerned, in the state of Washington, it's extremely permissive. It's almost as if marriage were grounds for a divorce. We have have 10 grounds which range the whole gamut. Most divorces are granted in this state and most other states on something that's called personal indignities rendering life burdensome. You wonder what that is. I can point to a recent case in which a man, this guy is a beast, you can see it on the very face of it, at a cocktail party, which was the occasion complained about by the wife, when she took a cigarette from her pack and put it in her mouth, he, yes, slobbering beast, seated across the room, did not get up and go across the room and light her cigarette. Can you believe it? Further, when they left the cocktail party, he did not open the car door, but went directly to the other side and tried himself.
Was that actually on the plane?
Yeah, sure. Are you surprised?
Well.
You see, we are involved in one grand mass hypocritic exercise here in which we say, holy, 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 and don't let that bother you. Go right ahead, Mac, and get your divorce. Because sociologically, we know that violence is going to result. Destruction will be the inevitable frame, but of course we wouldn't want to be in favor of this kind of thing, and so we are hypocrites. My profession leads the pack, perhaps. Those of you who are clergymen are pressing us hard. And then the rest of society either joins them in hypocrisy or else is utterly stupid. I don't know which, perhaps both. Well, I have one more thing I want to say, and that is, I have a whole bunch more things I want to say, but you want some coffee, and so do I, so we'll take just a couple more minutes, then we'll break. Maybe you'd like to talk about it later on another occasion, if so, I'm perfectly delighted to do so. What can we do, really, in society to protect, to somehow undergird, to make this system work again? You see, we have the family as our cardinal system for producing good kids. The medics like to draw on the Wetzel grid the development of a normal child. Given that kind of a line, if you take a child at birth out of the normal family environment, you don't rock him, coo him, you don't give him love and affection, tender love and care, for a few months, that curve of development goes under and may not reach, again, the child's normal development until it's an adult. Russia is, I suppose, our best illustration of what happens here. Russia started out with a very, very open attitude with reference to marriage and divorce. I mean, after all, it was just a crazy hang-up anyway. So ignore it. Take the children, born in or out of wedlock, who cares? It's an old-fashioned idea. Feed them well, keep them warm, and so forth, and they'll grow up strong and healthy. Well, and indeed they did, you see. Physically, no problem about this. You can shove the right amount of oatmeal down there, weigh them out, change them regularly. What happened is the kids did not develop intellectually. I do not say spiritually. You can make the applications over, as I would myself if we had a longer time to play with this. But Russia found on its own terms of desirabilities that children could not grow up to be good at rocket making and other things that are important in life like that without a stable home environment. And Russia today has gone on a cycle, you see, to where they are not only as much or more puritanical about the marriage relationship as we are, but actually have gone further and are doing things positively and constructively to try and preserve this unit in society which develops children. In the peculiar stance of our legal system, which I can only say I incorporate now by reference what I've been talking about the last couple of days, that is, law is negative. Law prevents things. It keeps you off my back and so forth. In this peculiar stance, the poverty of law, we have only been able to say, if you interfere in that marriage, we can hold you liable criminally as a marriage breaker, an adulterer, a bigamist, something of this sort, see, a criminal penalty. Or we can say, if you steal his property, his axe, his ass, or his wife, we will give him a civil remedy, a tort, for having taken his property. Alienation of affections, criminal consort, breach, any of the breach actions when a man interferes in another marriage. You steal his wife, we'll give him a judgment for $16,000 to compensate for the loss. See, this is negative stuff. Once in a while, when you get over into equitable context, How can I give you a half an hour lecture in 1 minute? Equity was the church in the old scheme before everything became in one legal system. Equity was the king's conscience. Originally, when things got real tough in a law action, if you didn't like the way it came out, you went to the king and you said, "Look, king, this is terrible. Maybe legal, but it's terrible. It's an unconscionable result." And if you could explain that to him to a place where his conscience got going, "This is terrible. See, I can't tolerate it." If you got his conscience quivering enough, he would ameliorate. We still do it. The governor of any state can set aside penalties and so forth. See, if you can get to the governor and make his conscience quiver with indignation, he'll do something. Well, back in the old English system, the early common law days, there was so much harshness in the law that they had the king like a bowl of jelly all the time. Finally, he had to institutionalize his conscience by setting up the chancellor over here and said, "Go talk to the chancellor. If he'll quiver, I quiver." Then, because the chancellor was a churchman, he used the church's remedies, and so he handled spiritual problems. And if he came in, somebody came in and said, "That's legal." It was legal, but it's intolerable spiritually, and the chancellor really got quivering over here. Now, the chancellor didn't have to go the law route by handling property questions and damages and so forth. He would apply spiritual remedies, spiritual sanctions. Make you pray harder or make you do penance, and if that didn't get through, he'd use thumbscrews. Or hang you from the rack, or help you purge your conscience. Of course, in equity, we still do this. If a man is in contempt of court, we send him off to prison, and we tell him he's got to stay in prison until he purges his contempt. And when he has shriven himself from guilt, we'll let him out. A man who's in prison because of contempt carries the keys to his prison with him. Any day he takes the bath, does what the tramps call nosedive, in sorrow and contrition for his sins, he can walk out a free man. He's purged. Now, the chancellor then had positive powers of decreeing what we usually call specific performance. It's just that you can't do something. In equity, you can tell somebody he must do something positively. Once in a while, somebody says we ought to use the equitable powers in divorce and order a man under the threat of thumbscrews if necessary. "I hereby, speaking as the law agent for the state of Washington, order you to go home, love your wife, and be a faithful husband." You got a little problem with enforcement, of course. Just how you can do this. "I hereby order you to drop your addiction. I hereby order you to stop smoking," whatever it may be. "I hereby order you that there will be no more liquor in the United States. Prohibition will work." It reminds me of the man under whom I served in the military, who put out one of the famous orders one day about what we're going to do the next day, and would start at sunup, and the last line said, "The sun will rise 5:15 by order of Colonel." It's something you can't do. Yet we could be much more effective using our social science techniques. And the law could take the man and the woman, set them down, and say, "You are now going to be counseled. You are now going to have your head shrunk by a head shrinker. Or you are now going to be socialized by Mr. Cohen in social work profession." See, you are going to do this. Courts have ordered people to go talk over their problems with doctors, with ministers, with psychiatrists, and almost invariably the answer has been you cannot impinge upon a man's freedom that way. You are destroying the integrity of a human being by ordering him to be brainwashed. Very, very serious problem there, which we do not have time to explore. But it gives you the floor of the notion of why society does not move vigorously into these problems which cause so much harm and so much loss in our society. Could you really order a man to go see a minister? "I hereby order you by force of law to go seek out a minister of your faith and study the scriptures and pray earnestly and become reconciled. And if you don't, we'll put you in prison until you purge yourself from contempt and decide to be loyal." Negatively, we've come into that problem. We have attempted to forbid people to marry again. We have set up periods of waiting. We've passed all kinds of hurdles in the way of getting a divorce. It isn't easy to get a divorce. Let's make our divorce laws tough. Let's narrow the round so they all have to go to the Virgin Islands. Let's extend the waiting period so they all evade by going to the other state. Let's not give them a divorce at all so they'll just live in bigamy. See? And the system is collapsing around us. Everybody knows that there are no illegitimate children born. Except maybe that it's gone from a few of the brides being pregnant at the time of marriage, now to about one out of every five. Since 1940, in my state, we have gone from one live birth out of every 16 being illegitimate, one out of every 38, down to one out of every 16 births, live births in the state of Washington. By the last survey I've seen, are illegitimate. 50% of the children born in many of the inner cities, sections of our cities, are illegitimate children. You see, our basic vehicle for controlling the genetic problems is collapsing around us. Not because it is not a sound idea of licensing people to go into the widget business, but simply because we have set out the wrong tests for qualification and for continuation. And I'm talking too long. You're able to go get some coffee and come back. Maybe we'll talk about this later.